Get her down.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to open up the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. I'll start by announcing that we're going to carry over House Bill 2154A and 2640B.
Okay.
And I would like to start and open a work session on House Bill 2958A. If you could remind us and give us a summary, Administrator Donovan.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2958A requires community colleges to make specified information available for distribution to public school students in grades 11 and 12 annually. It requires representatives of the State Board of Education and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to meet regularly for the purpose of improving coordination between the public secondary schools and community colleges. It declares an emergency effective 1st of July 2013. There's one set of amendments for this bill that the committee's considered, the Dash A2s, which amend the community college requirements with language to be congruent with recommendations by the Oregon Education Investment Board. And the committee heard this bill previously last committee meeting on the 21st.
All right, it was presented by Representative Comp. The amendment was drawn up by the community colleges. And I think we're ready to go unless the committee has any questions.
Nope. Chair Hass, I move to adopt the Dash A2 amendments dated May 16, 2013.
Senator Knoop moves to adopt the Dash A2 amendments dated May 16, 2013. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objections? Seeing none. So ordered.
Chair Hass, I move House Bill 2958A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knoop moves House Bill 2958A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none. Is there objection? Seeing none. Senator Beyer, we are to your name on our list of carriers.
Be happy to.
We close the work session on House Bill 2958, and I would like to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2898. We have a couple of presenters, and we have a couple of amendments, I believe. Senator Johnson is here for an amendment to that bill. Why don't we start with you, Senator Johnson, and you have a team?
Yes, sir.
Okay, come on up. Senator Gelser will be speaking on the underlying bill when you're done.
Thank you. First accomplishment, get here and didn't kill anybody.
But you still have to get away from here.
50% so far. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16. I am going to defer to my two local government colleagues, the Mayor of Scappoose and County Commissioner Earl Fisher, and then I will make some concluding remarks at the end of their testimony with respect to the Dash 1 amendments and why these are so important to Columbia County and specifically Scappoose.
Welcome, Mr. Chair. My name is Earl Fisher. I'm a county commissioner in Columbia County. We come down to let you know that we believe that this bill is very useful to our county. This is a county that is fiscally distressed. We have 26 days of furlough, and we believe that this bill will help us bring jobs into our area. The site that we're looking at has been looked on as a place for a higher education kind of activity for a number of years, 10, 15 years or more. And we just believe this will help bring jobs into our area, clean jobs, and we do not see a downside to it. It's something that our county can really use to help improve the educational environment in our community as well as our economic environment.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. My name is Scott Burge, Mayor of the City of Scappoose. I have served in either a city council position or mayor for 14 years with the city and was there at the end of what was commonly referred to by Senator Johnson as the Gravel Wars. This site, the Meyer site, is specifically the site of that site is part of what that was, a fight to stop it from being mined and having it mined next to the airport. And part of that vision was light industrial development for the airport and educational opportunities. As everyone knows, for economic development, having a physical presence of a college is a strong selling point for your community. And since we have 70% of our community that commutes outside of Columbia County for work, our goal is to have more people working in our community, living in our community, and playing in our community. And being educated in our community is also important. And so this site is very supported in this. I think it was 10 years ago when the DPSST went out for bid that this site was a finalist for that training facility. And we strongly supported that as a site for that. And when that stayed down in Salem, PCC became some interests in this site as a, or the city of Portland and PCC began interest. So we've been supporting this type of development on these acres for well over 10 years, closer to 15. And this development is kind of a cornerstone of our economic development vision in South Columbia County so that we can provide jobs and have an economic base and not have to depend on timber payments anymore and be able to be a self-sufficient county. Thank you.
Mr. Mayor, for those of us just coming into this movie, I feel like we watched the final 90 minutes of Mr. What's the hope for this land and the dreams, and how will this be the first step or the second step?
Mr. Chair, if I can answer that again, Betsy Johnson, I want you to picture the property, if you would. It's a 400-acre site that happened to be one of the richest gravel deposits maybe in all of Oregon. And for nearly two decades, protagonists and antagonists slugged at each other in the courts over the future of this site. A large multinational gravel company had proposed to dig a mine 800 feet off the center line of the runway. It would have devastated property that the city had looked at for a long time is the economic future of the city. I was one of those protagonists. We went through two United States senators, an FAA administrator. We slugged this out all the way to Washington, D.C. I'm told at the FAA that they had a big map of the United States with two pins in it, one on the East Coast, I don't know where, and the other in Scappoose, as two of their largest conflict problems. We actually went through a regional solution process, an Oregon solution process, to bring glasnost and perestroika to the gravel wars. The table was set among our enemies. We sat down, we found out what our mutual needs were, and came to the conclusion that there was more that united us than divided us. And so ended the gravel wars with an agreement not to dig this site and to project this site as truly the economic future of Scappoose. It's proximate to the airport and has adequate land to grow. We have a quality developer involved who has already put millions of dollars into the site. And then we were fortunate enough to try to compete for the DPSST site. We put forward Scappoose knowing that DPSST had largely made the decision to go to Mill Creek here, but it gave us an opportunity to talk to the community about a vision of a training facility that would one day have police there. We'd even offered this site at one time for a prison, and I can tell you the community liked a box full of cops a lot better than they liked a box full of cons. And so we ended up putting forward the site for consideration for DPSST. It was rejected. But the dream lingered on, and then appeared PCC. Scappoose and Columbia County are in the tax catchment area for PCC, but over the years that that has been the case, received virtually no services, but continued to pay taxes. PCC passed a magnificent bond and was looking for an opportunity to service Columbia County more fully. And out of that came a pretty robust discussion about the possibility of a training facility that would be both an urban police mission, urban fire, port security, maritime security, with a certificate from PCC that would have the same cachet at the Port of New York and New Jersey as it would down in Louisiana, as it would at the Port of Portland. PCC was very intrigued by that, retained consultants that did quite a bit of work reaching out to the police forces in the general area around Scappoose, Portland Police, out into Beaverton, talked about collaborations where no one entity could build a training facility that had these multiple missions, but partnered with a college backed by a magnificent bond. There was evidence that cooperation could deliver a facility. The PCC board remains committed to expanding their presence. They talked about a bricks and mortar facility that would do traditional classroom training, but as the notion of this post 9/11 public safety center began to catch on. They looked very favorably at the site that we're discussing right now and is the subject of the amendment. They still will build a bricks and mortar facility, but the site that this amendment speaks to would allow a an EVOC, an emergency vehicle operations training, like a track where you could run fire trucks around, run police cars around, do the kind of training that is needed by our increasingly sophisticated public safety folks. The difficulty is the land use. A portion of the 400-acre site is going to be included in the Scappoose UGB. It has been through several trips to DLCD, a trip to LUBA, all affirmed, almost unanimous out of DLCD. It has been to a vote of the people, and they have spoken that this is their view of the economic future of Scappoose. This amendment would make it possible to completely build out the facility. We're in the catch-22 that proper site design cannot occur without control of the property. Control of the property cannot occur without, frankly, this legislative action. We think that the background of this elevates it beyond just let's put another use in EFU. We think we have a fact situation that says that this is a reasonable exception, and we believe that we can make the case that a full build-out of this PCC Spire of Excellence, the public safety training facility, would be the future for Scappoose. We believe that it will attract ancillary industry. It is proximate to the airport. There's an awful lot of R&D going on with some different aircraft companies there. It seems that an airport and a public training facility have a nice nexus. And so when I close my eyes, I can picture a very robust physical plant of PCC delivering certificates that would be welcome to any place in the United States in the public safety arena, and also adequate development property inside the UGB to continue to build out a integrated industrial site that would service the aircraft community as well as other businesses that are looking to develop in Scappoose. The nice part about having aviation and aerospace R&D is that it attracts exactly the kind of companies that I think we're hoping to attract in Washington County and Columbia County. They're close enough to each other that they continue that kind of, I hate this word, but I'm going to use it anyway, synergy that development companies build among and within each other. So we think that we have the basis of a public safety facility here that will train students. I represent two towns that have community colleges, Astoria and Tillamook, and I am here to testify without fear of contradiction that having the presence of a community college is transformational. The whole attitude of the place changes. And I think that today's action by your committee, if you are willing to entertain this amendment to 2898, is the first step in realizing a long-term vision for Scappoose of employment. We have a 70% out migration every morning, and I drive Highway 30. I can tell you from personal experience recently, it's a congested and troubled drive. I would much rather have... I'm here to testify. We would much rather have those jobs, frankly, driving a half a block out to this new campus to find their employment close to home than getting in their car and driving to Hillsborough, no disrespect intended to Washington County. We think there's plenty of jobs for everybody. But this this amendment crafted onto this bill, I think, is the first step in realizing a 30-year vision in Scappoose. And it's one that the county and the city stand prepared to deliver as their legislator. I'm going to do everything possible. Representative Witt is fully on board with this, and we would ask your indulgence in entertaining this important amendment to move Scappoose forward and the development of this site.
All right. Thank you for that overview, Senator Cruz.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Chair. Just to put on the record, question for the commissioner. Outside of the small little technical change, I'm assuming we have no zoning or permitting issues to deal with. It's all been dealt with by the county. I just wanted to get that on the record. So thank you.
Senator Rowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm excited because we probably can push PCC over the 100,000 student range, largest school in the country and in the state. And I think this is a really great idea, and I agree with the vision of having a community college and a community and making it a really active place. And I look forward to voting for this bill.
Any questions? I think you're right about community colleges transforming a community.
Yep.
We've seen that happen. Now, if we could just fund them. That Ways and Means Committee members.
I would absolutely agree with that, and I would just respond, Mr. Chair, by your leave, to Senator Roblin. And that is, I have been around long enough to remember when PCC looked at the Rock Creek campus, and there were the naysayers that said, what the hell are you doing out here in the boonies? Well, out here in the boonies is now metropolitan Washington County. The campus is reaching capacity. Long-term, I hope I live long enough to see the Scappoose site realize that kind of enrollment and that kind of enthusiasm. It's possible, and on a site as big and as accommodating as this one, I think it's a vision that could be realized.
And there won't be any drainage problems?
None. Absolutely none.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. We don't know what you're going to do when you stop fighting gravel pits.
This is the end of it. This is the final culmination to a long and previously acrimonious, now very harmonious relationship with the gravel industry.
I will attest to a meeting that was held this session that showed that perestroika has been reached. So.
It has.
we still could go harvest gravel out of the rivers if we could change a few things.
Just saying. All right, let's not go down that road. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very
much.
Thank you.
And Representative Gelser is here to speak of the underlying bill that got us to this place.
Impressed, Bessie. Impressive.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, State Representative from House District 16, and I wanted to talk to you about House Bill 2898. In regards to the amendment, I've just seen it a couple of hours ago, and land use is a committee in which I have never had a bill. So there's one. I can't speak to the merits of that amendment, and my hope and my request is just that the underlying bill is very important to the students that we are bringing on behalf of, and I hope that we can hold that intact and move the bill in a form that allows that underlying goal to be reached. So the underlying bill does two things. The first is that under new federal law that went into effect this year, students are only eligible for federal financial aid, that includes Pell Grants and federal student loans, if they have a regular high school diploma or a GED. So that means that Oregon students that have graduated with a modified diploma will not be allowed to get any kind of financial aid for any kind of post-secondary program, including welding, culinary school, a child care certificate, any kind of a career certificate. That is a real problem, and it's going to be a growing problem, I believe, as we implement our math standards and especially the math proficiency in the OAKS at the end of the next school year. So this bill clarifies that regardless of the federal law, Oregon students who are accepted to Oregon institutions are still eligible for Oregon-based financial aid if they have been accepted to an institution. Doesn't change anything about the requirements for what makes you eligible to be accepted into a post-secondary program, but if you've met that bar and the college or university or program has said you're qualified to be in that program, then they would be eligible for Oregon financial aid on the same basis as any other student, regardless of the type of diploma that they have. The second feature of the bill is very... It addresses a similar problem. Students who have graduated with a modified diploma that don't yet have a regular diploma are, and if they are eligible for special education services, are eligible to continue receiving transition services from the age of 18 to 21. This bill modifies the definition of transition services to include earning credit at a community college or a university. So this really is basically another way of looking at our dual credit programs or our Running Start programs, where students are working towards associate's degrees or college credit while they are still in high school. This is a much better way for these students to be spending their transition years than just sitting in a high school classroom, which many of these kids don't want to do. With this change, for students that are eligible and for whom it is appropriate, they could then leave that transition program even if they don't have a regular high school diploma. They could possibly have a two-year degree. They could possibly have that welding certificate. They could possibly have that culinary arts certificate, and that contributes to 40% 40-40-20 in a different way. They may not have met that 20, but now they've landed in the 40, and they have much more opportunity to be economically successful and self-sufficient in their adulthood. And I think that's an issue that we are really going to have to grapple with these increased high school diplomas and standards. I am all about high standards for kids. I am just very worried that we are slamming some doors shut in the face of kids at the end of the 12th grade if they haven't met that high school diploma at that point, because so much hinges on that right now, and we've got to start thinking about alternative ways to moving these kids along the path to post-secondary degrees. Again, this wouldn't change the eligibility requirements for a student to participate in a college credit course. We wouldn't be asking community colleges or universities to modify anything that they are doing. The student would have to be qualified to be able to participate in that. I know there are some other folks here to talk about the bill and why it is important to the community. But the last thing that I would point out, a lot of times when I've talked to some of you about issues related to students with disabilities, it's focused in large part on students with intellectual and developmental disabilities. The impact of this bill is really a lot broader. If you look at the population of students with IEPs and Oregon students in special education by disability type, only about 15% of that population has autism or an intellectual disability. The vast majority of those students have a learning disability, like dyslexia or ADHD, and for those students, the regular graduation rate is still at about 42%. So those are the kids that we are talking about primarily in this bill. These are kids that will have AP social studies and AP history, but they're not getting a regular diploma because they have a problem in math and they can't get to that high-level math, or the reverse. They've got the AP science and the AP mathematics, but they haven't quite gotten where they need to be in the reading or the literature. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah. First, I support the bill, and the amendment isn't going to jeopardize it, just so you'll know that. I want to go off subject just for a minute. There was a rumor, Representative, that you and your committee was going to be taking the Oaks test. is that still something that's going to happen?
Senator Cruz, Senator Haas, the opportunity was completely voluntary, and as a result of that, Representative Springer and I will be taking the Oaks test, I believe, on June 3rd. And I am taking it in both math and in reading. I did not, and I'll just tell you, I left high school after the 10th grade and never had all of these subjects in math. So my middle school students are, my children, are sitting with me as I do Khan Academy, helping me to learn algebra so that I can do better. But I am expecting that I may not hit the meets. And just as an aside, I technically would not be eligible for any federal financial aid either if I wanted to pursue post-secondary education at this point, because despite my master's degree, I have no GED or high school diploma.
Mr. Chair,
these results be made public?
I will be happy to disclose whether I have met or not met.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I brought this up because Representative Gelser and I had had a conversation. I was going to challenge this committee to join them. Because quite honestly, it's been 2 or 3 years since I was in school. and I would just like to know how you know, huh? Senator Roglin.
Might be fun.
Yeah, I think it might be informative for us to participate in that. So I know you extended the invitation, and I, for one, will accept the invitation.
Well, I will let Jan McComb of the department know. They need to create, there's some special logistics that need to happen, so let me let her know. And if any of the rest of you wish to join, let me know today so that we can make those arrangements. And if there's another legislator listening somewhere in the building, would love to have you join me.
And as a parent who has been working with a teenage daughter on her homework, I can tell you right now that I'm opting out. I know.
She'll be so impressed by you, Senator Haas.
Yes, I know. She's very proud of me.
Senator Roberts. So I just want to assure you that the amendments will not have any effect with respect to the Senate, but I'm worried about concurrence. So I think we know somebody who has control over that, so we're hoping that they will continue to look at the bill and accept the fact that it could work really well over there.
Thank you. And I am not the concurring person. Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, I would point out that the concern we heard from the House was relative to land use, and we had on the record that the county's already gone through the process, and so I think that concern has been addressed.
I am opting out of the land use Oaks.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for keeping your eye on this population. It's important.
Yep.
Thank you.
Close public hearing on House Bill 2898. And we will come back to that. I'm sorry. We do have some other people here. We have a time constraint on this other bill. Okay. Let's go to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2995. If you can give us a quick summary.
Thank you, Mr.
While you do that, I'll bring up Bridget Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. House Bill 2995 requires each public university, community college, or other institution of higher education to allow students, faculty, and staff to identify sexual orientation on forms used to collect demographic data. The committee last heard this bill on May the 9th.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Bridget Burns, Chief of Staff for the Oregon University System. Today I wanted to offer comments in regards to House Bill 2995 and cite just a few concerns of the Oregon University System and identify for you how we're going to move forward to accomplish the goals of this bill outside of legislation. We are deeply committed to the success of all our students, particularly students who are LGBTQI. Our commitment is demonstrated by a variety of important campus-based programs throughout our university system, whether it's the QRC at OSU, Safe Zone Trainings at EOU, the PSU Lavender Graduation, the QRC at SOU, OIT's Gay Straight Alliance, the LGBTQA at U of O, Western Safe Zones. Our institutions have taken a unique community-based approach to supporting our LGBT students. We believe it may be helpful to have additional data about the number of students who choose to identify as LGBT, who choose to self-identify as LGBTQI. Though a meaningful way to gather that data is not as simple as putting a box on a few forms. And we believe our historic policy of shared governance points to developing a policy through meaningful consultation of our campus community, students, faculty, and staff to generate a policy that's appropriate for each of our campuses. The subject of House Bill 2995 is an internal policy area that does not require legislation. As a result of Senate Bill 242 and the managing authority of the presidents of our universities, this is clearly an internal campus decision. Each of our campuses has a unique culture, community, and language, which varies, and we believe the policy solution for each of our campuses should reflect the essential common denominator of shared governance. This could be so specific as the language of LGBTQI versus queer versus LGBT, or it could be as complex as at Eastern Oregon University, President Bob Davies frequently wears a clownfish pin because a member of their community is currently transitioning, and the clownfish changes genders multiple times throughout their life. And so members of the executive team of the Eastern Oregon University consistently wears a clownfish every day to raise the topic of conversation. It just depends on the community you're in, but we are very supportive of these students. This is a complicated matter because this legislation points to any form currently allowing self-reporting of race and ethnicity, which presents a body of case law we can look to when implementing data collection and use. A lack of best practices and precedent could present challenges for this particular population. We believe we should be very thoughtful about this to ensure that the data is confidential and is meaningful for us to be able to develop policy solutions to support these students further. To my knowledge, there's only one public university in the country, the University of Iowa, that has implemented this, and they went through an extensive and rigorous campus-based process prior to determining the appropriate implementation, forms to include, language to consider, and how to best connect self-identified students with appropriate resources. The rationale for the conversation at University of Iowa was to assess demand for student services and redirection of resources and develop awareness and intervention to address and curtail bullying and harassment. I would also add that what we saw at the University of Iowa, which is helpful, is that if you do self-identify on only their admissions form, so this bill talks about any form at the University of Iowa, it's only for the admission, and when you do self-identify, you are immediately connected to a variety of resources for these populations, which we think would be potentially very helpful, but it's going to depend on how we would operationalize that. So it's not necessary to pass House Bill 2995 as a legislative measure. Since our 7 university presidents will develop a campus-based process to accomplish the goals of this bill, our campuses have the authority to allow students, faculty, and staff to self-identify sexual orientation on forms pertaining to admission used to collect demographic data going forward. And I also want to put on the record that I will come back, or someone from the university system in my seat, and report to you in February and give you a summary of not just the process underway, but the outcome and hopefully examples of how we've been able to utilize it. We will be working to develop this policy immediately, and we will work with our campus stakeholders to develop strategies and timelines for enactment. We believe a campus-based process initiated by the premise of this proposed legislation will result in a more meaningful dialogue about campus services for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, intersex students, and will likely result in a far more meaningful outcome than simply adding a form to a box. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, but otherwise that concludes my remarks.
Thank you. I don't disagree with you on the need for legislation, and this is perhaps more complicated than what we have in this bill. I guess what I hear you say, and maybe you could reinforce, is that the university system is making a commitment to pursue this policy in a way that makes the most sense for each of our public universities.
Chair Haas, yes. We believe that our institutions should embark upon a process that is convening members of the community, their students, faculty, and staff on each campus to develop the appropriate approach. But yes, this outcome we plan to accomplish, and we will be able to report that back to you. Our presidents are very open to these ideas. We just had not yet been approached, and we feel like it's appropriate to use shared governance, which is typically our method to accomplish important campus changes. And we want to make sure that we can also spend this time to evaluate the student services and resources we provide to these communities. So I actually think that going through this avenue, you're going to end up with far more results because there's potentially going to be additional identification of resource areas needed that we would bring forward.
Thanks.
Thank you. Further questions? Okay. Thank you for coming forward. Gina Frazzini.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Gina Frazzini. I'm the Executive Director of Basic Rights Oregon. We represent tens of thousands of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and allied Oregonians across the state of Oregon. And I'm here to strongly urge passage of this bill, of House Bill 2995. While I very much appreciate the support of the previous testimony from the OUS in implementing data collection across the university system, I think that this approach outside of the legislation falls short of meeting the needs of our community for a number of reasons. The OUS doesn't represent the 17 community college systems across this state. And I have concerns, deep concerns, about the ability to collect uniform data and to be able to compare across campuses. And these are some of the key issues that surface as we seek to fully understand the experience of our community across this state. It was just 6 years ago that this legislature passed the Oregon Equality Act in 2007. Up until that point, it was still legal to lose your job, your home, public accommodations, access to education. While that's been an incredible step forward, and it certainly brings us to the point where collecting this kind of data in an environment where folks are protected from that discrimination is critical, it's still just the explicit discrimination that's been addressed. That legislation has certainly not significantly changed the experience of LGBT Oregonians in their day-to-day lives, and we have very little data through any data collection systems in this state that really help us to understand what's happening. Where we do have data nationally, we find that nearly a third of LGBT students drop out of high school. That's nearly 3 times the national average. That 1 in 5 transgender people experience homelessness. And homeless LGBT youth represent up to 40% of those on the street. Right here in Oregon, data from 2008 in the Too Afraid to Learn survey of over 3,500 Oregon college students indicated that a hostile campus climate is still having a significant impact on access to higher education. Over half of gay and transgender students concealed their sexual orientation on campus for fear of their personal safety, for fear of discrimination or of rejection. We have a population that has been consistently silenced and invisible, and not had a voice in a lot of the systems that they that are impacting them on a day-to-day basis. And we have had the non-discrimination law in place for 6 years, so that is a concern of mine, that the university system has had ample opportunity to implement data collection systems. They're collecting demographic data every day. They have not, up until this point, voluntarily collected that data on sexual orientation, gender identity, and so forth. Again, I just want to emphasize the importance of the clarity, the simplicity, and the consistency that's provided in House Bill 2995. So our preference would still be to see this in statute. Should you choose not to move the bill, we'll certainly make the commitment to work with partners in the OUS. And hopefully, I understand there's a Higher Education Coordinating Council. Don't know a lot about it, but that might be the place where we could address this with the community colleges, and we would commit to do so. But certainly would be back in the short session to bring the legislation forward again if we don't see the kind of progress necessary. So again, just underscore the preference is for passage of House Bill 2995. This is a community, again, who's been silenced and invisible, and our hope is to bring folks' experience forward to help us understand the underlying issues that are leading to lack of access to higher education, to homelessness, and to the other sort of items that we're seeing in the national data. Thank you.
Thank you, Gina. I really do appreciate what you said, and you know, in some ways we're feeling a little bit caught here. You heard what I think is a pretty sincere commitment from the OUS system to look at this in a way that may not be a one-size-fit-all scheme. And,
yeah.
And you heard the testimony about Eastern Oregon being different than Portland State and so forth. And
yeah.
That does make some sense to me. And so that is an issue here
right.
In front of us.
Yeah, I think that there are some pretty basic sort of ways that you're, you know, we're looking for, again, consistent data that can be compared across universities. And so we're going to have to end up with a consistent setup. And we're looking at this in terms of the demographic data collection. There's within our community, we certainly are a community of very diverse identities, and it is a challenge at times for folks to check one box or another. And yet, we have to have some sense of some basic demographic information that will allow us to, again, understand what's happening and to surface when we're looking at the kinds of research that's done on student populations right now. There's absolute invisibility for sexual orientation and gender identity. And again, this has not been an area in which our community has a lot of faith that it'll happen without our own advocacy.
Right. Questions? Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2995. I reopen a public hearing on House Bill 2898, and I would like to call Roberta Dunn and Steve McCoy to speak on 2898 and perhaps maybe the amendment. Okay. You're not here for the transitional diploma discussion.
Or the amendment. I'm here for the
amendment.
Not the amendment.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Chair Haas and committee, my name is Roberta Dunn, and I am the executive director of Oregon's Parent Training and Information Center, and we work to support families raising a child experiencing disability and support the 80,000, roughly, families with a child, either that is receiving special education or in the process of pursuing special education. I'm also a constituent of Chair Haas. My son graduated with an extended diploma last year at Southridge High School after working very diligent and making his way through accessing all of the necessary coursework that he needed. He now is a young man that is pursuing the opportunity to enjoy and to learn in post-secondary higher ed. He happens to be one of the 15 or so percent that Representative Gelser had mentioned that experiences IDD. But on behalf of this larger population, I'd like to just urge passage of House Bill 2898, because the demographic of our transition student today has changed. Some of us might have a picture in our mind of what a transition program looked like, and it wasn't all that long ago that if you were to visit a transition program for 18 through 21, it would look like a prep program for a sheltered workshop, because what you would be doing is primarily working on life skills and functional skills associated with activities for daily living. Today's transition student is not that student. Today's transition student is someone who is going to be charged by the state of Oregon to pursue employment first. And so we need transition programs that are strong and rigorous, that are going to have high expectations for all students, including the 15% with intellectual developmental disability, but more so for this new transition student that we're going to be seeing, who is a student who has otherwise fallen through the cracks. Maybe, as Representative Gelser had alluded to, has very strong skills in one area, but yet's not able to pass the standardized test in order to attain and achieve the standard diploma. These young people, they might be young people that just were done in the high school setting. The high school setting just might not have worked for them. And if we could get them through to open the door to higher ed, these might be young people that are become engaged and do become part of our 40-40-20 achievers, in that they can, similar to Representative Gelser, might not have achieved a high school standard diploma, but go on to either finish vocational training, receive a certificate of some time, but we really do need to open the door. I happened to hear, Chair Haas, your testimony yesterday for 222A, and really appreciated how you had challenge that we needed to open and widen the students that are able to access higher ed, that we don't want it to just be our affluent and our gifted and talented, but we want it to be that middle group. Well, on behalf of the 80,000 students experiencing disability, We'd like to hold on to your tail. We'd like to fly that kite with you, because we think that there's a lot of young people who are receiving special education who will benefit if we can open those doors to our higher education. Thank you for the opportunity to provide this input.
Thank you. How old is your son now?
He's 20, and he's currently going to be starting his last year of transition programming. Yes.
Terrific. Any questions for Mrs. Dunn on the underlying bill 2898? Thanks. And Steve, I had you both down on the amendment, but Steve, I think you want to address the amendment.
That's correct.
Okay.
Excuse me. Chair Haas, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon, here to talk about, excuse me, the Dash Ones. We are neutral on the underlying bill. It's obviously not part of our subject area. So this is a pure land use amendment. I'm not even sure if this really fits into the relating to clause. It's relating to education. And the Dash Ones are clearly about land use. Our written testimony focuses on supersiting and talks about how with supersiting there's no analysis of need necessary. There is no analysis of other sites as well. And that's what the Dash Ones do, is they step around that analysis. Under current law, you can either establish a need, and this is the right place to do this, and do a UGB expansion, or Senator Johnson talked about how the importance of protecting exclusive farm use lands and said, but this is an important exception. That's the other process, is the exception process. For exceptional circumstances that require a non-farm use to be sited on farmland, you can take advantage of the exceptions process, which was created for exactly this type of thing. Requires an alternatives analysis and a justification of the use. And this makes sure that the use is necessary and it is going to the right place to maintain the agricultural economy. So we oppose the dash one amendments. Thank you.
Okay. On the relating clause is the one thing I can, is it does fit.
It does, okay.
According to our legislative council
office. Okay.
Questions? Senator Beyer?
No.
Okay. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
I will close public hearing on 2898, which brings us to our final bill today, House Bill 2749. Rep. Fagan was here, and okay, she's got a constituent and a team of people up here. Jamie Onchi, why don't you come on up, and why don't we just bring up a panel of Morgan Allen, Andrea Cooper, and if you could give us a summary, Richard.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2749A requires school district boards to allow certain medications, in this case specifically epinephrine auto-injectors or EpiPens, to be kept in a student's classroom if requested by the student's parent or guardian, and if other conditions are met. It declares an emergency effective July 1st of this year. The committee has not previously heard this bill.
We have not heard this bill, but we have heard a bill similar to it, Senate Bill 611, the other EpiPen bill, and now we're going to hear why they're different, why we need to, and
well, we're moving it from the office to the classroom is what we're doing, I think, basically.
Jamie, did you want to go first?
Yes. Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, my name is Jamie Onchi, and I'm advocating for House Bill 2749 on behalf of my 8-year-old daughter. Jaden. I'm speaking today in hopes of change, informing you of my experience with the Clackamas School District and my realization of how unprepared schools are in regards to food allergies and epinephrine availability. Jaden became peanut and tree nut allergic at 18 months of age. Jaden's allergy is so severe, if she becomes exposed, she'll have an anaphylactic reaction. Anaphylaxis is a type of allergic reaction in which the immune system responds to an otherwise harmless substance from the environment. Unlike other allergic reactions, however, anaphylaxis can kill. Reactions can begin within minutes or even seconds of exposure and rapidly progress to cause complete airway obstruction and death. 1 in 13 children under 18 years of age in the U.S. has food allergies. That's roughly 2 to 3 children in every classroom. Every 3 minutes, a food allergic reaction sends someone to the emergency room. Food allergy is the leading cause of anaphylaxis, and epinephrine is the first line of defense to treat anaphylaxis, and it's the only medication that can reverse the symptoms. Failure to administer an EpiPen within minutes is a risk for a fatality. Teenagers and young adults with food allergies are at the highest risk of fatal-induced anaphylaxis. Studies show that the number of children living with peanut allergies appears to have tripled between 1997 and 2008, and there's been an 18% increase in food allergies from 1997 to 2007. When Jaden entered kindergarten at Sunnyside Elementary, I was prepared with all the medication forms and the doctor's authorizations. I went to school thinking it was going to be a great day. In turn, it was a nightmare. After explaining Jaden's food allergy and handing over her life-saving EpiPen, I was informed it had to be kept in the office because this was the policy for the medications. As a pharmacist and a mother of a food allergic children, this was unacceptable to me. To cut a long story short, I spent most of the day driving back and forth from the doctor's office and having more and more paperwork signed. In the end, the EpiPen was in the classroom. Jaden switched schools in first grade, going back to our zone, Scatters Mountain Elementary. Similar situation. In the end, the EpiPen was in the classroom the first day she started school. Currently, 15 states have food allergy guidelines, and 7 states have stock EpiPen laws. After many late night researching food allergies and joining several food allergy support groups, I've come to the realization that change within the school system needs to happen. Reading heartbreaking and unimaginable stories of children exposed to their food allergies at school when schools were informed time after time the severity of their allergies, teachers who simply forgot, kids who were bullied and had their food allergens wiped on them, kids whose lunches were accidentally mixed up, or kids exposed during a classroom party. Too many situations that can put the life of my child in danger. Do I think every situation is unavoidable? No. Do I think schools have a responsibility to make sure that my daughter is as safe as possible? Yes. If one of these situations happens, I want to know that they have an emergency plan of action in place and epinephrine readily available to save my daughter's life, and that will only happen if it's in the classroom. Food allergic children are covered under the 504 Disability Act. Schools are prohibited by federal law from discriminating against students with food allergies and are required to provide them with the same educational services and activities that other students receive. While the students are in the custody of the school has a responsibility to keep them safe. Since food allergies are potentially deadly, the consequences of a school's negligence in protecting the food allergic children can result in legal and financial liability. For that reason, a good food allergy plan is not only in the best interest of the food allergic child, it's in the best interest of the school district. What I would like to see changed in the schools would be to adopt policies and procedures and guidelines regarding food allergies, to identify all food allergic children and require EpiPens be stored in a classroom if a parent so chooses, procedures for informing substitute teachers when there's a food allergic child in a classroom, and to make policies universal across Oregon. Don't allow each individual district to decide how they want to approach food allergies and medication. I want to know that when Jaden gets on the bus in the morning, she's going to get off in the afternoon. I don't ever want to get a devastating call from the school to say that she was exposed today and we didn't have an EpiPen in her class. She didn't survive. Thank you for your time, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Ms. Alanchi, we thank you for coming here and advocating on behalf of your daughter and others. I have a daughter who we need to carry an EpiPen around for, so I understand. Ender.
Morgan. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Morgan Allen on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. And Senator Cruz was correct. The bill you heard earlier session dealt with school board policy, best practices and guidelines to deal with food allergies, and allowing school districts to buy EpiPens and, you know, put them in the nurse's office or have them in the med kits in schools without having to have a specific prescription linked to a specific child so they could be on hand. And this bill deals with the other side of the equation, which is getting EpiPens into the classroom. So I'll make my comments brief. We think this is the right balance between student safety and liability for school districts. As you heard, right now, school districts have the final say on where the EpiPens go. And unfortunately, in some instances, some schools or some building administrators have decided that those EpiPens need to be kept in the classroom or in the nurse's office. And this bill gives parents another tool to nudge the school district to get that into the classroom. Essentially, it says if for some reason the EpiPen's not in the class, then the parent can request in writing and get a doctor's note to ask for it to be in the class if it can be kept safely in the class and it's life-threatening. So the goal is to get those EpiPens in the class, and hopefully it would, unless there's some extraordinary circumstances where safety of that EpiPen cannot be secured in a classroom environment, the idea is that the school really should work with the parent and get that EpiPen in the class, and that's what we'd hope to see. We hope this is enough to do that, and we'd be happy to come back and push it a little further if it doesn't accomplish the goals, but we think it will convince folks that they really need to get those pens in the class. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Hess, members of the committee, for the record, Andrea Cooper with the Oregon Education Association. We also wanted to share support for this important policy. We believe children should feel and be safe when they're in the classroom and on the school bus and under the care of educators. I also wanted to extend a thank you to Representative Fagan and Jamie for approaching both Morgan and I about this bill very on so that we could find policy that met that important balance. I think the other note that I will make that is that we appreciate in this bill is that it
maintains the requirement to train employees. Medication and tools to save lives are only as effective as the person who's administering it, so having that element of supporting educators and school employees to know how to use an EpiPen is also important. We thank you for taking on this issue and for Jamie's wonderful testimony.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. I just said, since our parent is also a pharmacist, is that what I heard? How much training does it take to administer an EpiPen?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roblin, when somebody comes to my pharmacy, I give a 5-minute consultation, and that's the first thing and usually the only time that a parent ever learns or an adult learns how to use an EpiPen. I've heard, lots of questions about, an 8-hour training that a teacher would need to be EpiPen trained. I have no idea what they would talk about for 8 hours on how to learn to use an EpiPen. It has, a lot of stigma because it has a needle on the tip of it, but it doesn't come out until you actually inject it into the thigh.
And
follow up.
And how much do they have to worry about taking the pant down or doing anything with an EpiPen?
No, as long as the clothing is pretty thin, it can go through the clothing. If it's, thick jeans and they actually have time to pull the pants down and administer it, that would probably be advisable. But if there's no time, then
right through
the pants will work.
Thank you.
As a parent, I had to do this once, and the only training, it wasn't even training, but it was a scene from Pulp Fiction.
That was different.
And I did it, and it was in the thigh, and it worked.
Right.
And these do work, and they're lifesavers.
I absolutely agree. Having allergy kids myself,
The training is a tricky thing because people do think, it's like AEDs, mm-hmm. they think that you need training.
Well, they're self-explanatory. When we did that was a good thing, too, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for your testimony. Thank you for coming in and advocating. And I think we do have the proper fiscal documentation here today to pass this out, but there's a wrinkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. There's a potential conflict not with the actual legal conflict with Senate Bill 611, which is our previous measure, but there's a hypothetical wherein under Senate Bill 611, a school could have possession of EpiPens and have them in the classroom, and there could be a child that is allergic but unaware that they're allergic. It's a very unlikely scenario. Senate Bill 611 is scheduled for work session on the 29th, and that the House Ed Committee anticipates amending that measure to resolve that specific uncommon circumstance. So whichever bill were to make it out of committee first would be the other one would be amended. So this one shouldn't affect it at all. I don't know if Representative Fagan wants to.
Rep. Fagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Richard. Just to confirm, Shamia Fagan, State Representative for House District 51, for the record, yes, my office sought an opinion from LC to see if there was a conflict, and you're right, in a very narrow, odd set of circumstances, there could be a conflict, so we're already working on conflict amendments, should not be a problem.
Okay. And so that doesn't stop us from sending it to the floor.
Yeah. Cool.
All right. Then I'll close the work session on 2749. Open. I will close the public hearing on 2749 and open a work session on House Bill 2749.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2749A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2749 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Hearing none. Is there objection? Mm-hmm. Hearing none, House Bill 2749A moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do-pass recommendation. Senator Roblin will be
carried.
I knew
the list. I knew how it was going. So
you know the list. Okay. And to repeat, we are carrying over House Bill 2898 and 2154. And 2640. We are adjourned.